Bane.
Bane?
Yes, good morning, sir.
I'm rather distressed at the papers this morning. I don't guess you've seen the Washington papers.
No, I haven't.
But Kraft says that this whole thing was worked out. Ball and Harriman. Ball went over and saw Harriman. And really, Ball Harriman wrote this speech for Humphrey. And then that Nixon fell into the trap of saying that they laid for him, of saying it hurt the negotiations. So Averill started commenting on the speech and saying it didn't hurt the negotiations. And now Nixon's been trapped and Humphrey's really...
Did Averill comment publicly on the speech?
Yes, he's a damn fool. He's been playing politics. I found out from Cy, he didn't want to tell it. And I was just shocked to death. And I asked him, I said, did anybody discuss this speech with y'all? And he choked and hung up. And I said, were you consulted about this speech? And he said, yes, sir. I said, who consulted you? He said, George Ball.
For heaven's sake.
And so that just ruins us with the other side when that comes out, in my judgment.
Got a new proposal. I'm sending him back up here to get him away from these columnists now, this town, before you come down this week.
I'm sorry, I can't hear, Mr.
I say I'm sending him back up there to get him away from these columnists and out of town.
Right.
But so you can talk to him if you want to. I don't think it's essential, but you'll probably want to give him a ring sometime on the weekend, whenever you can.
Yeah,
I don't.
Coming to New York.
Yes, I don't think it's necessary you come down here until you find out more than you know.
All right.
But here's what Kraft says. In the Vietnamese speech, had a carefully prepared public buildup. A major speech was announced by Kraft 3 days in advance. Leading advisors, Under Secretary Ball and former Postmaster General O'Brien, were on hand. The text itself, while not altogether clear, was artfully wrought. The Vice President moved toward a total halt of the bombing North Vietnam in a way that placed his position far in advance of that laid down the most recent statements of the President and Secretary of State Rush. The speech was hardly over before Mr. Ball was pointing out to various press people how the Vice President's stand differed from the current posture of the administration. At the same time, the halt in the bombing was made conditional in a way that protected the Vice President against the one man whose public disapproval he genuinely feared. That man is the chief parish negotiator, Averill Harriman, whose views had been recently sounded by Mr. Ball. As to organizing the reaction, Senator Kennedy's chief aide, David Burke, was briefed in advance on the speech by Van Dyke, an hour Kapitstein, O'Brien's man. Kennedy followed the speech with immediate telegram of approval. Senator McCarthy was given advance by Finney, a Washington lawyer, formerly top-hand McCarthy, so the senator hadn't said anything because he's committed to remain neutral while reporting the World Series, but the way is open to him to express approval of the Vice President's advanced position. Lastly, a trap was prepared for Nixon. It was expected the Republican candidate would reply to the Vice President by raising a question as to whether Humphrey's advance towards a total cessation of bombing would not adversely affect the Paris negotiation. Mr. Nixon did as expected, and arrangements were immediately made for Ambassador Harriman to deny the Nixon insinuation. All this does not mean, of course, that the Vietnam speech was a major triumph. On the contrary, the Vice President is still way behind, but he's beginning to show the qualities that could make the campaign a serious contest. And if he keeps it up, he begins to focus sharply on the issues and so forth. Now, Evans Novak's got the same Ball briefing, apparently. Ball has complained bitterly to close friends about what he regards as a stiffening of Johnson on the question of bombing. He is convinced that this stiffening has compromised the negotiating team in Paris. Specifically, Ball has said that the President's actions in Honolulu wrecked the careful diplomatic probe by Harriman, the President's chief agent. Although precise details are confidential, there's reason to believe that a break in the Paris talks was imminent before Johnson went to Honolulu. These culminated in an extraordinary hour and a quarter tete-a-tete between the two heads of state. If there was a memorandum of conversation of this long and private talk, it is a closely guarded document. In Washington, details of the long talk are known only by a very few of the President's most intimate advisors. Thus, the agreements made by Johnson in return for concession by two are still a state secret. But Ball and other members of the President's official family believe that the conversation contains certain agreements that convince the communists in Hanoi, the United States was not bargaining in good faith. Accordingly, the careful diplomatic initiative nurtured by Harriman and his aides in Paris was pulled up by the roots. Partly as a result of this, Ball has confided to intimates that Humphrey was placed in an intolerable political bind. Further, this bind was closed tighter by Johnson's repeated contradictions of Humphrey's whenever the vice president claimed to see some glimmer of light. That, then, is the background of Ball's much-criticized decision to desert the United Nations. Only one day after his confirmation by the Senate, Ball's first job for Humphrey was to help write his Vietnam speech so as to minimize charges Humphrey's selling out the Paris negotiations. Ball first talked with Humphrey about this speech 2 days before he quit the UN. He spent much of last weekend conferring with Humphrey on the West Coast. He then returned with Van Dyke and O'Brien. He was, in fact, indispensable as Humphrey spelled out the difference between his position and Johnson. And while the president demands specific de-escalation or quid pro quo from Hanoi as a condition for stopping the bomb, Humphrey is willing to assume good faith without Hanoi spelling out a quid pro quo. Although this difference is a major one, the careful diplomatic language of Paris, the immediate political reaction home to Humphrey's speech raises doubts whether it went far enough to accomplish its purpose to persuade the McCarthyites to work for Humphrey. As Humphrey's newest advisor in short, it's possible Ball may soon yearn for the peace and quiet of the UN. Then Murray Martyr's got another story. HHH paid the price for the bombing halt. And he says that they've told him over there, Harriman and company, how they feel, and they're much softer than we are. Now then, all of that's very bad. What's really bad, though, that I can't justify at all, because they're in politics. I wouldn't comment on it. I told the State Department not to comment on it. But, Chief, here's the headline. Humphrey didn't impair talks, Harriman said. Chief Negotiator Harriman sees no basis for thinking Humphrey's Vietnam speech could jeopardize the peace talks here, spokesman said today. Harriman authorized the spokesman to disclose this position and thus appeared to be rebutting indirectly the criticism of Humphrey's speech by Nixon. Today at the 24th session of deadlock talks, Harriman's counterpart said so, and then they quote him. As regards Mr. Nixon, the warlike presidential candidate, wait a minute now. Harriman's comments surfaced when U.S. delegation spokesman Harold Kaplan was asked at his briefing whether the American negotiators had any feeling along those lines, referring to the remarks by Nixon and sharper criticism by Tower. No, Kaplan replied, I don't think there is, but then insisted this should not be taken as comment on Humphrey's speech. Kaplan said he did, quote, discuss the general notion of the government Harriman, and he specifically authorized me to say that he sees no basis for the...